All right, we are back. I stumbled upon a meme recently that I think we should quote from. It says that Einstein said this in 1949. Quote, "There will come a time when the rich own all the media, and it will be impossible for the public to make an informed opinion," end quote.
What did he know?
Well, it sounds like a legitimate quote from Einstein, and even if it's not, it's a legitimate sentiment. When we have gone out of our way on this program for the past couple of decades to combat. As mentioned at the top of the program, part of our efforts to bring you something that will enhance an informed opinion was our chat with Pete McCloskey. Allow me to quote from his obituary that appeared in the Bay Area News Group, a piece by Paul Rogers. Paul N. Pete McCloskey, a decorated Korean War veteran, Marine, who beat celebrity Shirley Temple to win a seat in Congress, represented the Peninsula and South Bay in the late 1960s, and then became the first Republican in the House to call for Richard Nixon's resignation. He was also a co-chair of the first Earth Day. He has now passed at age 96. A colorful, contrarian figure for generations, McCloskey died in his house in Winters, in rural Yolo County, of congestive heart failure. In passing through Capay Valley a few months back, I mentioned Pete McCloskey in one of the local stores, and the people there just sort of chuckled and said, "Yeah, Pete." The clerk, in fact, pointed out that McCloskey was now living in his mother's former house in Winters, and that although he was a bit ill, he was hanging in there. The obit notes that throughout his life, McCloskey was known as someone who put principle over politics, even when it ruffled feathers. A square-jawed iconoclast, he was a prominent member of what today is nearly an extinct breed in Congress. A liberal Republican. I don't think it's nearly extinct. I think it is extinct. McCloskey was also a champion of environmental issues, who saw his work as a continuum of the conservation efforts of former President Teddy Roosevelt. And I am tickled to note that one of the photographs accompanying this piece shows Pete McCloskey walking down a road to Martin's Beach in San Mateo County. McCloskey took up the cause of the Surf Riders Foundation, which challenged the closure of the property after it was purchased by venture capitalist Vinod Khosla. It's kind of a pleasure for me to look at McCloskey walking down the street and know exactly where that photo was taken. The piece notes that McCloskey was co-chairman of the first Earth Day back in 1970 with Senator Gaylord Nelson, a Wisconsin Democrat. McCloskey was a strong supporter of passing the Endangered Species Act in 1973, something he talked about a great deal to Ms. McMillan and I. Joe Kochet, his law partner since 2004, said, "Pete stood for everyone without a voice and was especially passionate about our environment. He was afraid of nothing or anyone who sought to take advantage of another. He was the epitome of a leader, as demonstrated throughout his entire life." The piece mentions that McCloskey graduated from Stanford University and Stanford University's law school, but his time there was interrupted by a Marine Corps service. As a Marine Corps rifle platoon commander, he saw some of the most difficult combat of the war, earning the Navy Cross and Silver Star, along with two Purple Hearts. They note that during his 10 months in North Korea, 58 of the 61 members of his platoon were either killed or wounded. Now, in an effort to originally solicit McCloskey for this program, I found myself at his law office in San Mateo. One of his partners showed one of McCloskey's books of his adventures in the Korean War. I'm not sure that it was Joe Kochet, the man mentioned in this piece. I hope I still have that book. It shows a picture of a grinning McCloskey in one of the photos who, apparently, according to the law partner, had just rather mischievously rolled boulders down onto the outhouses where some of the officers were relieving themselves. Again, he's our kind of guy. In 2011, notes the piece, McCloskey gave one of the Purple Heart medals he earned to former Representative Jackie Speier, saying that she had not been publicly recognized after being shot 5 times in Guyana in 1978 when she visited Jim Jones's People's Temple. Her boss at the time, Representative Leo Ryan, was killed in the shootout. Speier lay on the remote tarmac at an airfield for 22 hours awaiting help. McCloskey told the LA Times at the time, "She earned it. She got hurt worse than I did." McCloskey served as the president of the Palo Alto Bar Association and taught legal ethics and political science as a guest professor at Stanford and Santa Clara Law Schools. In 1967, he took on what seemed to be an impossible political task. He ran for Congress to succeed Representative Arthur Younger, a World War I veteran who had died in office of leukemia. But he had another, much more well-known opponent in the Republican primary, former child superstar Shirley Temple Black, who most political observers expected to win easily. But Black reportedly ran a lackluster campaign, including holding rallies that featured the song The Good Ship Lollipop, which she made famous in films as a dancing child star. Doesn't seem like a good move. McCloskey told the Mercury News in 1986, everyone thought Shirley Temple would win in a walk. She could have if she'd not exposed herself to be so ignorant of the issues. But, of course, McCloskey added, Temple Black later became an enlightened public servant in the UN and in various diplomatic posts. For 8 years, McCloskey repeatedly enraged the conservative wing of his Republican Party before retiring from the House in 1982 to run unsuccessfully for U.S. Senate. He lost the Republican primary race to San Diego Mayor Pete Wilson, who eventually defeated Jerry Brown in the general election. Almost from the moment he took his seat in the House, McCloskey began calling for the U.S. to withdraw from the Vietnam War and seek a gradual unification of its North and South. And in 1971, he announced a rather quixotic campaign for president against Nixon. And unfortunately, in American politics, the incumbent is rarely challenged by members of his own party, no matter how much he may deserve it. McCloskey said at the time, to talk as the president does of winding down the war while he's expanding the use of air power is a deliberate deception. I'll probably get licked, but I can't keep quiet. After Nixon won re-election and became embroiled in the Watergate scandal, McCloskey called for him to resign. Then Vice President Spiro Agnew called McCloskey a Benedict Arnold. And something else I really enjoy about Pete McCloskey that's not well known but was in that book that I got in his law office, and which he later expanded upon when we spoke with him, was that he helped end conservative Reverend Pat Robertson's presidential run in 1988, revealing that the televangelist was not a combat veteran, as he'd claimed. McCloskey documented how Robertson's father, U.S. Senator A. Willis Robertson of Virginia, used political influence to get his son out of combat duty by having him sent to Japan for safety during the war, where I believe, according to McCloskey, he was in charge of distributing liquor to the troops. Robertson sued McCloskey and lost. And when we caught up to Pete McCloskey back in 2006, he'd re-entered politics. He was running against 7-term Republican Representative Richard Pombo of Tracy. McCloskey lost in the primary election, but endorsed Pombo's Democratic opponent, Jerry McNerney, who won in the general election. And by the next year, outraged over mistreatment of prisoners in the Iraq War during the Bush administration, McCloskey switched to becoming a Democrat. And I think at this point, let's go back and pull up excerpts from our chat with Congressman McCloskey. Well, I want to note for our listeners that for many years, you championed environmental legislation, yet you always held office as a Republican. And I think that must seem remarkable to many people today, given the current stands of the GOP. And I guess that is sort of a sad commentary on where things have gone.
Well, my family have been Republicans in this state since 1859. My great-grandfather went to Yreka and then down to Merced County, where he was a farmer. Both he and my grandfather were members of the Republican Central Committee of Merced County in the 1880s. So it was hard for me to become a Democrat. But I'll tell you, after Gerry Ford, who was a wonderful man and pro-choice, and then George Bush Sr., who were great Republicans, I like Bob Dole, but after them, the party has turned more and more right-wing, not only against family planning, but against birth control. And that kind of knocked me over the edge. In 2007, I became a Democrat.
Well, I'd like to turn the clock back and review it how it is you came to Congress. You were a Stanford grad, both undergraduate law school, decorated Marine. You had been thriving in the legal world. And I'm just kind of curious as to about your relationship with that Bay Area Republican Party, because when you ran for Congress, you had to go up against Shirley Temple Black, and she was certainly a party stalwart.
I won, I think, because it was a special election where Democrats could vote Republican, Republicans could vote Democrat. There were 11 candidates, and Shirley Temple should have won. She had the name recognition. She had the backing. I was against the Vietnam War then at a time when 2-to-1 were for the war. I won in spite of my views. But I had a lot of good friends that came and walked precincts for me on election day. And when I was elected, primaries, 68, 70, 72, 74, there was blood on the floor. I won only because two other guys split the vote. The Republicans hated me. I mean, the Republican Party prayer breakfast would meet and pray to nuke Hanoi. I mean, I just didn't fit in to the Republicans until Gerry Ford became president. And he and I were good friends, and he was a wonderful man. And so I had, because of Gerry Ford, after 1974, when Nixon finally resigned, I had eight more years in the Congress where I was a working congressman. We had a Democratic majority. But in those days, Democrats and Republicans talked to each other politely, with courtesy, with respect. And legislation was enacted because they could compromise. And I had wonderful chairman, John Dingell of Michigan, was a wonderful man on the wildlife stuff. Mo Udall of Arizona, wonderful man. Dave Obie of Wisconsin. We had mutual respect. I really regret that when Newt Gingrich came to power in 1995, he ended that friendship. Democrats to him were enemies, traitors, not patriotic Americans. And so by pushing that view as he had, and then with Bush Jr. becoming president, the Congress has lapsed into something that I would not want to be in today.
We're somewhat surprised in talking to McCloskey to learn that he and John Ehrlichman of Watergate fame were actually pretty good friends.
Well, I made the first speech to impeach Nixon for obstruction of justice, because when he came out and he announced he'd fired Ehrlichman and Haldeman, he said, "I've ordered the FBI to stop investigating the CIA, which had discovered the money trail from his lawyer Herb Kalmbach to Mexico City to Bebe Rebozo to the wireman, and the wireman would deliver it at the second overlook on the Potomac Parkway to Mrs. Hunt to keep Hunt quiet. And Hunt was threatening to sing. Sirica was saying, you know, I may throw away the key on you unless you tell the truth." And so they were delivering, I think, 10 or 20,000 each week to Hunt to keep him quiet. And it was the trail. In any event, when Ehrlichman, our friendship ended when I made that speech about impeaching Nixon. And I'd done it in 71, I guess. And so our friendship languished until he went to jail. And then I go to see him at Safford, Arizona on Thanksgiving Day, I think 76 maybe. And I flew down to Tucson and I got two big turkey sandwiches crammed with cranberry sauce, you know, the deli kind. And I drive over to Safford Prison, and there's no fence around the Safford Prison. There's a bunch of Indian tribes and desert, and you don't go anywhere. And it was Thanksgiving Day, so they let John off, and we sat in these rickety stands. He'd gone from having a limousine and the worship of the world to living with 69 Mexicans in a barracks. There were 70 people, 35 cots to his side, and Ehrlichman didn't speak Spanish, and none of the guys, these guys were all in for 5 months and 29 days for having crossed the border 63 times or something. Well, we're sitting out there, and I said, "John, whatever happened to you? You know, you were a wonderful lawyer, an honorable lawyer, and what happened? You lied to the grand jury, you lied to congressional committees." I didn't ask him about going down to Santa Monica to offer the head of the FBI to the judge if he would suppress evidence in the Ellsworth trials. That was the worst of the things he'd been doing. Well, he looked across the desert for about 30 seconds or more, and he finally said, "Pete," and I've remembered these words, I'll always remember it, "Pete, it took us 3.5 years to be corrupted by the power of the White House, but we came to believe that the re-election of Richard Nixon was essential to the national security." Not against McGovern, who was a decorated pilot in the war. Those words stayed with me because to justify everything with the national security, burglary, wiretapping, the invasion of Ellsberg's doctor to discredit Ellsberg, the same thing exactly happened when Joe Wilson pulled the string on President Bush and said he'd lied about the yellow cake in Nigeria. So what's the response? Cheney outs Valerie Plame for 21 years of the CIA and says she's fair game to discredit her husband and say that she sent him to Nigeria on a junket. you know, and the CIA wouldn't stand behind. The power of the Dick Cheney exercise, this book I've just written that I've given you, I've said if we could go back to international law, it would be a small price to pay to send Cheney and Rumsfeld up for trial as war criminals, because they and their lawyers accepted torture in violation of the Geneva Accords and violation of international law. And the greatest thing Putin ever said, I'm no fan of Putin, but I think last year our government banned 18 Russians from Washington because we thought they were spies or something. Putin responded, and he said, "I banned from coming to Russia because they're war criminals, John Yoo, who was Rumsfeld's lawyer, David Addington, who was Cheney's lawyer, and Jeffrey Miller, the general who supervised the torture at Guantanamo and then was sent to Iraq." And he said, "They're war criminals." And I think they were war criminals. There's a book called The Trial of Henry Kissinger for Making War on the People of Vietnam. So this wasn't a war. This was a war against the people of Vietnam because they were harboring people who wanted to support the Viet Cong. Well, we executed General Jodl after Nuremberg because he had done the same thing. He had moved against villages and deported their people because they supported people that were, in his mind, terrorists. We executed him.
Right.
We executed General Yamashita after World War II because his troops had committed crimes against Filipinos. Well, if we want international law, we in the United States have to abide by international law. And so the Bush administration, to me, was a tragedy. That's why I became a Democrat. I couldn't stomach their sense of values about torture and about making war.
Anyway, I recall with great fondness the hours Mr. Miller and I spent with McCloskey at his home in Cape Ay Valley. But because his wife was missing in action and was not there to help prepare lunch for we trio members, the ever-enterprising McCloskey dug out crackers and cheese, in addition to some scotch. Hell of a guy, he is missed already. And someone else I'm missing already, whom I only found out about his passing a few hours ago, is Dr. Cyril Wecht. As much as Pete McCloskey stirred up things in the Republican Party, Cyril Wecht, I think, did the same in the Democratic Party. I would note that I first encountered Dr. Wecht when he was having dinner in San Francisco with author Josiah Thompson. The two men had known each other for many decades. I was palling around that evening with Dr. Gary Aguilar, who was intent upon crashing that dinner because he had some information he wanted to bring both of these men. And so it was that we two did indeed crash the party like a couple of Cossacks. I want to especially thank both of their wives for putting up with us. Wecht, as you may or may not know, made a name for himself in many arenas. The one in question that got us crashing the party was his interest in the JFK assassination. Wecht believed that the medical evidence in that case was thoroughly buggered, something we find it impossible to disagree with. But when we finally had him on the program, this is actually show number 69, back in 2004, we talked with him not about the assassination of JFK, but rather that of his brother, Robert F. Kennedy. Now, we've been rather critical on this program of RFK Jr.'s running amok and pretending he's running for president. But I think the one thing I've heard him say that was dead on correct was his description of how it was his father died. And for that, we will now turn to forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht for his explanation of what happened.
You talked about that a trial is not a search for truth. In the case you mentioned was Sirhan Sirhan, the murder of Robert Kennedy. On this show, we previously heard from ex-FBI agent William Turner and
yes.
Lawrence Teeter, Sirhan's attorney.
Yep.
You agree with both these men that although Sirhan fired a pistol at RFK, there's no doubt about that, he surely did not kill him. Can you tell us why you agree?
It was definitely a second gun.
The shot that killed Robert Kennedy, number one, had a slightly forward trajectory, entering in the right mastoid area, that is behind the right ear, and moving forward. And number two, more importantly, that shot was fired from a distance of 1 to 1.5 inches away from Robert Kennedy's head. There's nobody in the world that has ever placed, to my knowledge, Sirhan's muzzle 1 inch away from Bobby Kennedy's head.
We're speaking with physician and lawyer, Dr. Cyril Wecht, one of the country's most distinguished forensic pathologists. So I presume you support, along with Lawrence Teeter, calls for a new trial for Sirhan.
Well, sure. Yeah. You know what? You see, what I just said, there are people out there listening to you saying, come on, what kind of nonsense is this? Where was the jury then? Well, the fact of the matter is, and this is something that, you know, nobody except people in the case or have studied it realize that this statement that I just made, this finding, this conclusion, this forensic scientific fact was never presented to the jury.
Yes.
Noguchi did set it forth in the grand jury. Tom didn't hide it or hold it back. But in the trial, obviously the prosecution wasn't going to run with it. And Grant Cooper, who was supposedly an experienced defense attorney, I don't understand, how did he miss it? Was he bought off? Was he simply old and over the hill? Was he so tied up with saving Sirhan's life and pursuing the diminished capacity defense, the infamous Twinkie defense that you guys in California have, and so on, that he never evaluated the rest of the forensic scientific evidence? It's possible. I didn't know Grant Cooper personally, so I can't pass judgment. But what I'm telling you, I'm talking facts. I'm not talking about theory, conjecture, or whatever. There's no way that Sirhan's gun was 1 to 1.5 inches away.
Right.
And I'm talking about more than a dozen board-certified experienced forensic pathologists, including three from the United States government, who all agreed that that was the distance of the shot. Now, how do you handle that?
Would have been interesting if they perhaps would have offered the argument in the court of law that Sirhan was actually innocent, instead of saying, oh yeah, we stipulate he did it, now we're just going to argue about his state of mind.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, I would refer anyone who wants to know more about that to your book, Cause of Death, Chapter 2, Evidence of a Second Gun, which is a very good summary of all this.
Yeah, thank you.
I do want to note that I was privileged to attend a couple of events at Cyril Wecht's home in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I had a chance to speak with the aforementioned Thomas Noguchi at that event. And although I've got a few stories I could share from that and other interactions with Dr. Wecht, the one that sticks out most in my mind was a conference that he held. I believe it was the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. And ever the politician, Wecht had become friends with Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, he, the inventor of the single bullet theory. Wecht was chatting with Specter, who was about to mount the stairway and go up on the dais and address the public, when we could hear Specter say, they're not even going to know who I am. The irrepressible JFK researcher Jerry Polakoff was sitting next to me, and Polakoff barked out, oh, we know who you are, which did cause Specter, at the end of his talk, to at least twice look in my direction as he was making excuses for the various findings of the Warren Commission, thinking that I might have been the one that mouthed off. And frankly, I was kind of grateful for the acknowledgement, even though Polakoff had already moved to a front row seat by then. And you know, Mr. Miller, I don't think we've actually noted the passing of Jerry Polakoff on this program. Maybe we did. I hope we did.
I believe that we did.
Yeah. He appeared in the show 3 or 4 times and was always always a great interview. Anyway, that's another guy we miss around here, Jerry Polakoff. He passed away a few years back in an automobile accident, but he did some great work. Although I'm tempted to finally delve into the disturbing items in the news that we're skirting somewhat, I guess I can't pass up the opportunity to do a couple of brief obituaries. Since that's what we're doing in this segment, we'd like to note briefly, the passing of former governor and senator Bob Graham of Florida. What I think I like most about Senator Graham was that he was an outspoken opponent of the Iraq invasion, arguing that it would distract from the pursuit of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and could cause blowback in the form of further terrorism. In 2002, Graham thundered at his fellow senators, "Blood is going to be on your hands." We think reading a bit about Senator Graham would be worth your while, and perhaps might also be worth your while to read up on Joe Lieberman, another senator who passed away last month. We had some fun in the early days of this program doing a burlesque of Senator Joseph Lieberman, who was, as you will no doubt recall, in 2000, Al Gore's running mate and the first Jewish candidate on a major party's national ticket. Of course, 8 years later, he backed John McCain for president while dismissing Barack Obama as the lightweight. Joe Lieberman was a hawk. He championed the Iraq War. And he was also a moralist who excoriated then-President Bill Clinton for the Monica Lewinsky affair. But he was also a staunch backer of abortion rights and environmental protection. And finally, a quote we've used in the show many times, which we just love, was from a British wag whose name escapes me at the moment, once pointed out that the news consists of informing people that Lorne Jones is dead, even if they never even knew that Lorne Jones was alive. The guy that I never was aware of being alive, who is now dead, is John Sinclair. John Sinclair was a pot smoker who apparently inspired John Lennon. John Sinclair was, back in the day, the face of the effort to legalize pot. And by the way, the federal government is making noise about decriminalizing pot. Of course, Richard Nixon, in his wisdom, thought fit to put marijuana as a Schedule I drug back when he initiated the war on drugs in 1970. Which meant at the time, and I think on the federal level, still means that you cannot do research on THC unless you're trying to show how harmful it is. Anyway, back in 1969, John Sinclair got sentenced to a decade in prison for offering two marijuana cigarettes to an undercover cop. He then became a cause celeb in the counterculture movement. A 1971 protest concert for him in Detroit drew more than 15,000 people, including John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Evidently, within days of this event, the Michigan Supreme Court released him on bond and eventually overturned the verdict, ruling that he'd been entrapped. Sinclair said his incarceration was the best thing that ever happened to me, adding, "It exposes the fascists who put me there." Evidently, when Michigan got around to legalizing marijuana in 2018, Sinclair was one of the first in line at the dispensary. Reportedly, when someone standing in line next to him said that things seemed to have come full circle, Sinclair replied, "It'd be more full circle if they came and gave me back the weed they took." All right, we too have come full circle on this program and need to bring things to a close. I think we're going to have to promise you that in the next installment of the program, we're going to address all of these things taking place in the world that we find so discouraging and worthy of shunning. But until then, we would note that this program, like all of them, was produced by Mr. Edward McMillan, who we would note never did time for selling two joints to an undercover cop. I'm your host, Douglas Everett, who unfortunately did once run afoul of America's marijuana laws. But it was certainly no big deal. And in the words of Lorenzo St. Dubois, from the movie The Producers, "I'm clean now, man. I'm clean." But in truth, I never was a pothead. But unlike former President Bill Clinton, when I did try it, I did actually inhale. But I was always a bit wary because they assured me back in high school days that it led to harder drugs. An absurdity you still hear. But anyway, that's it on time. I'm Douglas Everett. This has been Radio Parallax. We'll see you real soon.